abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Tuesday, December 17th, 2013. What is to be done about poverty around the world? That's our subject for today with our guest, Michael Matheson Miller, who is research fellow and director of Acton Media at the Acton Institute. Acton.org is their website, but much of his current work at the Acton Institute involves leading poverty cure, promoting entrepreneurial solutions to poverty in the developing world, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. Michael Matheson Miller, thanks very much for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, I first became aware, I mean, you and I have met in the past at the Acton Institute, but I first became aware of Poverty Cure. I'm sorry for being so dense and out of it, but because somebody posted on my Facebook page that, hey, you should have somebody from this organization on your program. And I looked at it and I said, holy cow, of course I should have somebody. I mean, because you're talking to a guy right now who I once said, I was on Fox News and I once said, I would support foreign aid only if I hated the human race. And then somebody went and started a Facebook group called I Would Support Foreign Aid Only If I Hated the Human Race. And then I looked at this, at these wonderful stories and examples of ways that don't involve government-to-government aid that have really transformed people's lives. So I thought, all right, definitely we're doing this. So before we get going on the substance of foreign aid, why not, and entrepreneurial solutions, why not, first tell us a bit about what Poverty Cure, povertycure.org is the website, is all about.
Well, part of the idea of Poverty Cure is we wanted to really engage the question of how do we think about poverty? How do we think about poor people in a different way? And so one of the things we do, I think this comes out of good intentions, is we see poverty and we say, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? What can I do to help? How can I alleviate poverty? And as I said, I think this comes from a good heart, but I don't think it's the right question. I think a better question is, how do people in the developing world create prosperity for their families and communities? Now, it sounds like a little shift. Well, okay, that's not a big deal. But actually, if you think about it, it has tremendous impact because it takes the focus off of us and what we're going to do to come in and save and have people and help build their economies, and puts the focus where it belongs, on people who are the subjects and the protagonists of their own development. You know, Pope Francis, before he was elected Pope, had this line when he was the Archbishop of Buenos Aires. He said, we can oftentimes make people into the objects of our charity, right, instead of the subjects of their own development. And I think, unfortunately, despite good intentions, this is across the board, so many well-intended people, we've tended to make poor people the objects of our charity, if they're somehow different from us. And so part of the goal of Poverty Cure is to reframe the debate and talk about entrepreneurial solutions to poverty rooted in this creative capacity of the human person, right? Created in the image of God. They're with creative capacity. And so, and then to think, okay, so what does this mean? How does that mean that we engage with people in the developing world? And also the other thing we wanted to do, and I think you can see this in our video series, you can see it on our website. We have a documentary that'll be out early next year, is that too often poor people are portrayed as somehow incapable, like sitting there, you know, with flies on them, like objects, like we're looking at them as objects, instead of as competent, capable, energetic people. And one of the guys I interviewed is quite blunt, Herman Chinray Hesse. We did about 150 interviews for this project, Tom, and we interviewed people all over the world. We interviewed everybody from the development economists like Hernando de Soto to the director of the Center for International Development at Harvard, Marcela Escobari, Paul Collier, who wrote The Bottom Billion, the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame. But we also interviewed a guy called Joshua Omoga, who lives in the second largest slum in Africa outside in Nairobi called Kibera. He borrowed $8 from a friend to start a business. We talked to him. I talked to a Ghanaian entrepreneur, Herman Chinrehese, and I'll tell you some of his stories later. But he said something very powerful. He said, look, there's so many people, right, that are stuck in a hole with all their skills and all their talents, and that's unfortunately just the way it is. He said, the people here are not stupid. They're just disconnected from global trade. That's all. And so one of the things that Poverty Cure is, we wanted to, as it were, represent poor people, not as something different, but just like us.
All right. Of course, I love to hear stuff like this. But yet, I want to start with the bad and get to the good. I want to start with what has not worked. And of course, what has not worked is a policy that does exactly what you're telling us to avoid. And that is the state-led development programs that involved a transfer of wealth from the West to these developing countries. And this was the conventional wisdom in the 50s and 60s. And then by the 1980s, people were beginning to abandon that conventional wisdom. Although, starting in the 2000s, that now we hear about the new economics of foreign aid, which, if you look at it closely, sounds an awful lot like the old economics of foreign aid. But what is it that went wrong initially when they tried what, as you say, seems to be well-intentioned and seems to be superficially what you would think needs to be done? These people don't have capital. Let's hand it to them. These people don't have money. Let's hand it to them. What went wrong with that?
Well, I mean, I think some of it, as you point out, I mean, it begins really of this kind of modern concept of the last 70 years of this idea that if we could just marshal large sums of money and send it over to the developing world, we could jumpstart economies. They could make the jump into industrialism and take off, right? And some of this comes from the Marshall Plan, right? The idea, you know, the Marshall Plan was that after World War II, we're going to rebuild war-torn Europe, and the United States contributed some money to this. Now, look, there's debates about the Marshall Plan, which we could get into, but I don't want to get into that, because let's just assume the Marshall Plan worked. Whether it did or not is another story.
Yeah, right.
Still, it's only about 2% of GDP to highly developed economies. What was been given over in foreign aid is sometimes up to 13% of their 15% of their economy. And so, as you point out something very important, we think of foreign aid, people think of foreign aid. Let's make some distinctions here, right? I know your listeners are all on top of this stuff, but sometimes we think of foreign aid as just money that we give to the developing world. But foreign aid, as you alluded to earlier, is tax dollars go to our governments, which then send money to either international organizations, or they send them directly, and then those international organizations and our government, European and the United States, send money over to governments in the developing world. So these are government-to-government transfers, and they're for things like infrastructure, roads, you know, healthcare, electricity, et cetera. Okay. So this idea somehow that we can jumpstart economies, that was behind it. Okay, because a big problem of poverty needs a big solution, right? The problem is that what happened is, several things went wrong. Number one, this money oftentimes would subsidize corrupt governments who would actually take the money and not give it to the people in need. Okay. Number two, it began to create a big industry around it, not only international organizations like the United Nations and the World Bank and all these things, but a whole group of what are called non-governmental organizations, NGOs or charities, who actually get money from foreign aid money to either implement projects or work with people in the developing world. So, for example, Catholic Relief Services gets about 70% of its budget from foreign aid money, which is public money, right? There's a consulting firm called Chemonix. You can find this on the internet. They got about $500 million in government grants, right, from USAID money. So what happened is a big industry began to develop, right? That includes government or agencies like USAID or British ODA or Swedish Aid or Japanese Aid, JICA, big organizations like the UN and the World Bank, IMF, and then non-governmental organizations or private charities like Catholic Relief Services, World Vision, etc. And they all actually are, a lot of them are taking this government money. Okay? So what happened? Well, a couple things happened. One, foreign aid tends, as I said, it can subsidize dictators, which is, you know, clear. You've seen that especially with the case of Mobutu. It's probably the most the case in Congo, Zaire. But it also delays the development of business in Africa, because instead of when we give away free things, we actually crowd out local entrepreneurs. And the other thing that I think is you call it the public choice problem is that how do people get out of poverty? What do they need to get out of poverty? Well, they need things like private property, free exchange, free association, the ability to start a business. They need justice in the courts. They need all these things. And who provides that? Right? Well, local governments in the developing world, right? They provide that. Okay? And they have an incentive to provide that, because when people create prosperity, that creates taxes, a tax base. Right? So governments rely on people for a tax base to be able to survive. Well, Tom, what happens when you don't need a tax base, because foreign aid substitutes your need for a tax base? One of the guys I interviewed, Mike Fairbanks, he said, foreign aid cuts the sovereign link between a government and its people. So the government no longer has an incentive to create private property regimes and allow, make it easy to register a business and provide for justice in the courts. Instead, the government gets involved doing all these things it shouldn't be doing and doesn't do the things it should be doing, because the aid system creates incentives for them not to do those things. Then you hold the whole industry. What happens if poor people get out of poverty, Tom? Yeah. The aid industry goes out of business. So unfortunately, despite good intentions, we didn't really pay attention to economic incentives and to human action. We didn't pay attention to how people actually operate in a marketplace, right? Economics is not just mathematics. Economics is how people operate in a marketplace, and we take incentives seriously. So what happened is this foreign aid system, and I know I was probably there complex, this foreign aid system has created the incentives for governments in the developing world not to build the institutions of wealth creation, and has created incentives for all these people in the poverty industry to stay in the business. And I can tell you, let me give you one other example. Here's another thing that aid does. So it delays development of business. It also creates deep-seated crony capitalism. Okay? So I was talking to Herman Chinrahese, the Ghanaian entrepreneur I told you about. He told me the story. He said five companies got together to bid for a government project in Ghana. All right? Everything was going very well. They're about to get the job. One of their competing bidders was a European company. And they got their government to make a soft loan to Ghana on the condition, of course, that they would get the business. So he said, look, the government came up to us and said, look, we love you guys, but nothing beats free money. So we lost the business. Okay? Here's another thing we do. We subsidize our agriculture, we overproduce, then we send free food over to the developing world, or unfair tariff food under the developing world. We disempower local farmers, and then we blame free markets. Okay, what we have is deep-seated crony capitalism. I talked to Theodore Dalrymple, and I told him about Herman's story. And he said, oh, of course, I worked on projects like that. I've worked on projects where there's no way the company would have gotten it in an actual market, okay? And so much of foreign aid actually becomes a subsidy to companies who do the work, right? And Dalrymple said beautifully, he said, yeah, aid's been very good to me. I bought my first house on the proceeds of aid. So what has happened is, despite the good intentions, and I want to be very clear here, most people who work in what I call the poverty industry are not out to make a buck. Okay, they're not out to make a buck. They're out to actually help. But what's happened is that we've created a system that prevents poor people, excludes poor people, and prevents them from creating prosperity for their families and communities, and has created a deep-seated crony capitalist poverty industry where the poor are just excluded and people who work in the poverty industry benefit.
All right, let's turn this around then, Michael. Let's talk then about what the good stories are. Like, you know, we've, at the beginning we said we need a complete paradigm shift. We need a change in the way we think about this. Instead of, hey, what can I do? What can my government do? Instead of, well, what can these people do? Well, right. What have been the fruits of trying to push the conversation in that direction? What are some practical fruits of your efforts?
Well, I think, I mean, some of the fruits of our efforts, I mean, you and I talked about this. I mean, one of the things Poverty Cure does, what we do, is basically three things, right? First of all, we're trying to shift the paradigm of how we understand and think about poverty. Two, we do training and engagement through this Poverty Cure DVD series, which is a six-part, 152-minute curriculum, that video curriculum that tells a lot of these stories. And then the third thing is we have a network. We have about 250 partner organizations. And some of these are people who work with orphans, people who do microfinance, people who do small, medium investment enterprise loans, et cetera, et cetera. So part of what Poverty Cure is doing is trying to reframe the debate and then bring people together who are operating in a way that is not encouraging paternalism, but really going alongside. So one of our partners is a group called Partners Worldwide. They're actually here in Grand Rapids, where we are, at the Acton Institute. And Partners Worldwide, they help companies develop. And so I've actually met some of the people that they've helped. One company I met was in Haiti. Two Haitian men started a group called Enersa, which produces solar panels. Now, most people are shocked to find that solar panels are actually made in Haiti, okay? And so they're hiring guys out of Cité Soleil, which was, I think, in 2004, the UN said it was the most dangerous place on the planet, okay? And they're hiring guys out of Cité Soleil. They're having jobs, they're taking care of their family, and they're transforming local economies. The problem is, there's two problems. One is, look, that's exciting, but it's not big, and we're always looking for a sexy solution. Right, we're always looking for the next kind of cool thing that's going to be the silver bullet to solve all poverty. But you and I know there is no silver bullet to solve poverty. People get out of poverty when they're enabled to exercise their God-given capacity and they take care of their families and their communities. And so what you see with the story of Enersa, the Haitian solar panel company, is precisely that. But guess what, Tom? Guess what one of their biggest challenges is? Okay, besides a rough business climate in Haiti, one of the biggest challenges are free things given by non-governmental organizations so they can't actually sell their goods. So they were selling 50 to 60 street lamps a month. They make solar panel street lamps. After the earthquake came in, there was an influx of free things, and they were selling five a month. So it's not only foreign aid that hurts. It's actually private charity that hurts, right?
I don't know. Part of me can't quite accept that. I mean, I on a common sense level, I get it, that it's hard for me to get going and get an industry going if free things are coming in. But I don't know. I mean, can free things really be bad? I mean, surely somebody benefits from getting free things.
Sure. I mean, somebody does benefit from getting free things on a short-term basis. So let's take an example. The Peter Greer told me the story. It's a really little, minute example, but I think it helps. So he was in Rwanda, and when he was there, he got to know a guy named Jean. And John had just started a business of an egg business where he bought some hens, chicken coop, was selling eggs in the community. Now, a church in Atlanta decided that they were going to help. This was after the genocide. And so, again, well-intended people, they sent over eggs to this community. Okay, what they didn't know is that Jono had started this business. And so when the free eggs came in, you can't compete with free. And so Jono was put out of business. So a year later, the church said, okay, well, we've done our good here. Let's move to the next group. Let's move to the next area. And so here, this community got free eggs for a while, but in the long run, they lost the productive capacity. Let me give you another example. Tom's Shoes, which you've probably heard of. You buy a shoe in the United States, and then a shoe is given to somebody in the developing world. Okay? So this is great. I mean, you get a short-term benefit because some child, poor child, gets a shoe, okay? But what if there's a local cobbler in that area who also has children, right? What if local business is trying to develop and this unpredictable donation of free shoes comes in? It can put people out of business for a long time. Now, here's the thing, I think, that where I think you're maybe saying, like, hold on a minute, what's happening? And it's this. When this stuff comes in, okay, it comes in erratically. It comes in, there's no way that it's not like a market operation where people say, oh, this is a lower price. It doesn't make sense for me to compete. right? Instead, it's this kind of erratic shoe drop or medical supply drop or T-shirt drop that comes in, and people have no method of information to discern how is this coming in, when's it going to come in next. So actually, the free things, whether in the form of private charity or foreign aid, can often actually delay and undermine the development of business in Africa and Latin America and Asia. So I think that's one problem. You know, there's another problem. Tom Shoes, for example, he said, you know, we want to give away free shoes for life. But there's something fundamentally wrong with that. I mean, would you want somebody to give your children free shoes forever? No, of course not, because you can provide for your children yourself. Right. So part of it is just the way we look at poverty, the way we think about free things. Sure, there's a time for emergency help, okay? There's a time when there's a crisis and there's an earthquake, or there's a time when, you know, after war, we can come in and it's a time for us to give free things. Absolutely. But the problem is we've taken the emergency model and we've made that into a long-term model of development. And what that does is actually undermine the development of local business. So that's why free things hurt, because they're not simply, it's not like you have this constant flow of free things and you know, okay, I don't need to go into that business because the free stuff's coming in. You don't know, and it's always erratic, and so it undermines local development and sustainability, and it creates unemployment for people.
All right, let me ask you I want to ask you a few quick questions. Let's say somebody said to you, this sounds great. I mean, I'm all in favor of business enterprise developing, people starting businesses of various sizes in the developing world. That's great. We all know they need to do that. That's obvious. But they're too poor to do it. I mean, it's easy for you to sit here and talk about how wonderful the marketplace is. But for heaven's sake, when you're earning, $3 a day, where do you get the capital to start a business?
Okay, well, there's a couple things I'd say to that. I mean, first of all, I would encourage that person to go to the developing world and go spend time with people who are making $2 and $3 a day. And you'll discover that these people are entrepreneurial. I mean, somebody, a person said, like, in order to live on $2 a day, you got to be pretty entrepreneurial.
That's a good point.
Okay? You know, and I think, like, there's a couple of things in this, right? First of all, there's the microfinance issue. Like, you know, microfinance is developing. Microfinance is not a panacea, but it helps people get from abject poverty to poverty. It can be helpful unless it's done like commercial credit. Okay, so there's a lot of possibility going on with people who can really start small and grow a business. This is how economies have grown throughout history. These people in Africa and Latin America and Asia are not somehow radically different from us. They're not somehow incapable. Right. So the problem is we look, and this goes back to the key element. We go down to this question that you asked, and I know you're asking it hypothetically, is, are they somehow different from us? Are they somehow incapable of building economies on their own and that they need us to come in and help them? How do you think we grew? We didn't grow with foreign aid. We didn't grow with other countries developing us. No, we grew with people working hard, exercising their capacity. What poor people lack, and here's the key thing. We have this false idea that we can end poverty by giving people stuff, okay? But people are not poor because they lack stuff. People are poor because they lack the conditions of justice that enable them to create prosperity for their families and communities. And these are things like, look, these are things like private property. You know that in some countries, 70% of the land has no title. You don't know who owns the land, number one. Number two, it's almost impossible to register a business. Hernando de Soto, who I know you've read, yep. Hernando de Soto did a study in Peru, and he had four lawyers go out and try to register a business, just like a poor woman would, riding the bus, taking the time. It took 289 days to register a little business, unless you know the minister. Because if you know the minister, you can do it in one or two. Okay? Poor people are excluded from free exchange. You know, Tom, I'll talk to places, and people are shocked when you hear that. Like, wait a minute, don't we need to protect the poor from competition? But think about this for a second. When a government heavily regulates an economy, who does the regulating? Big business, big government, and interest groups are the ones who dominate that. So what happens is, when there's no free exchange, and a government is highly regulated, the poorest of the poor, they lack the political the economic and the social contacts to navigate a system that's dominated by big government, big business, and bureaucracy. And so they get excluded. So unfortunately, what's happening in the developing world is governments are doing all the wrong things. They're not actually helping to build the institutions of wealth creation. And so the real problem is not that people are too poor or they don't have enough stuff. The real problem is that what Acemoglu and Robinson in their quite good book called Why Nations Fail called, there are extractive political and economic institutions that take from people instead of allowing poor people to create prosperity for themselves. I'm sorry that's a long answer, but I think your question hits on like four or five misconceptions of why poor people are poor.
All right, let's do an even quicker one. I would think that people, let's say, who disagree with you politically, who might favor a more government involvement in trying to alleviate poverty in other countries, I would hope that they would say, you know, somebody like Poverty Cure, this organization, their approach is incomplete, but because doesn't have a substantial enough government role, but what they're doing though is valuable, and I would like to see it succeed. Is that the attitude that people who might not be completely on board with you have, or have you faced just outright hostility?
You know, interestingly, we actually have under 260 partners. We have people from the right, left, and the center. You know, I mean, there's going to be some kind of hard left people who are just absolutely focused on the government who aren't going to listen. But I think, you know, a lot of people across the political spectrums, let me say two things they realize. Number one, we actually do believe there's a role for government and that there should be private property rights, and that requires the government. We believe there's a role for government in enforcing justice in the courts so that it doesn't matter if when we go into business, my brother-in-law is the judge. You know that you're going to get fairness in the courts and not have to have your things stolen from you because you don't know the right people. We believe that there's a role for government to allow for people to exchange freely and that they're not ripped off. So we don't think there's no role for government, okay? What we just think the governments need to do the things that they're capable of and not try to corner the coffee market, for example, okay? Number one. Number two, I think people on the left and the right should all agree that crony capitalism is a problem. And when you see that a lot of foreign aid, I think when people who are like authentic supporters of foreign aid because they think it helps the poor, when they realize that millions and billions of dollars in foreign aid money actually goes back to corporations in the United States and Europe, I think they begin to say, wait a minute, something's wrong. Something is wrong, and this idea of foreign aid, maybe it was a good idea, but the way it's worked out has subsidized dictators, benefited big corporations, and the poorest of the poor who are trying to help just aren't getting the benefit. So I actually have found not hostility from people from different areas, but in fact, a refreshing openness and willingness to discuss with us. And we have partners who we don't agree with on everything, but they've joined because I think there's an increasing recognition that the system is broken and that it creates the conditions for crony capitalism, and people on the right and the left should be opposed to crony capitalism.
Well, we are out of time, but I want to urge people to check out povertycure.org. It's incredible to me that you're on the verge of 1.2 million likes on Facebook, which is borderline impossible unless you have a TV series or you're on the radio 24 hours a day. I mean, it's basically impossible to do that, so that's miraculous as far as I'm concerned. But Michael Matheson Miller, thanks for your time today. It's a wonderful work you're doing, and best of luck with it.
Thanks, Tom, for having me on your show. It's nice to talk to you.
And that's our chat with Michael Matheson Miller. Don't forget, this program is going to be taking a break around Christmas time. December 23rd will be our last program until January 2nd, so you can catch up on some of the episodes that you missed. Meanwhile, don't forget 35% off for gift subscriptions to my LibertyClassroom.com, which is the best gift you can give to your liberty-loving friends and relatives. LibertyClassroom.com/secret is where you get that secret deal just for listeners of this program. And then finally, don't forget you can help us keep the lights on in our little Tom Wood Show office by making your Amazon purchases through our Amazon widget at TomWoodsRadio.com. If you enter Amazon from there at no cost to you, you help us out. Tomorrow we'll be joined by Sheldon Richman, who's going to be talking about separating school and state. You won't want to miss that. See you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.